Views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss with Biden administration officials a prospective Rafah operation, according to White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who says each party is making clear to the other its perspective. At a news conference, Sullivan said President Biden remains concerned about how Israel will protect civilians during a Rafah operation.
The president told the prime minister again today that we share the goal of defeating Hamas, but we just believe you need a coherent and sustainable strategy to make that happen.
Biden and Netanyahu spoke on Monday for the first time in more than a month. The World Food Program, the United Nations Food Agency, said Monday that famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where over 200,000 people are believed to be experiencing catastrophic hunger. VOA's Rick Pantaleo with more.
The World Food Program and other UN agencies released a report on Monday that says a further escalation of the war, now in its sixth month, could push nearly half of Gaza's population to the brink of starvation. Arif Hussein is the chief economist of the World Food Program.
In northern Gaza, famine is imminent starting from now till May of this year. So it's a very short window to act. There are about 1.1 million people in catastrophic level of hunger.
Hussein said, according to the new report, if there is not cessation to the hostilities, if displacement continues, if they are not able to bring enough food and access for people, that there is a famine which could even happen in the rest of the country by July. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Israel is urging the top United Nations court to reject the latest request by South Africa for interim orders to prevent starvation in Gaza. The request is part of a case accusing Israel of breaching the Genocide Convention and its military offensive against Hamas. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin's election is now behind him, and he says Russian forces aim to set up a buffer zone inside Ukraine. Details from AP correspondent Charles Ledesma.
After extending his rule in an election that stifled opposition, Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow will not relent in its invasion of Ukraine. Putin also again warned the West against deploying troops to Ukraine. A possible conflict between Russia and NATO would, he says, put the world a step away from World War III. Commenting on the prospects for peace talks with Kyiv, Putin reaffirmed that Russia remains open to negotiations, but won't be lured into a truce that will allow Ukraine to rearm. In addition, the president said, he plans to create a buffer zone along the border to help protect against long-range Ukrainian strikes and cross-border raids. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Notorious coup leader Guy Philippe has aligned with the gangs who want him to be president of Haiti. VOA's Sandra Lemaire with the Creole Service says Philippe was instrumental in the 2004 rebellion against former President Jean Bertrand and has powerful ties to police, politicians, and the business elite.
They want him to lead a three-person council, and they're talking about basically inaugurating him rogue style at some point this week. Some people say it'll be tomorrow. Other people have said it might be Wednesday, but that's what they're planning.
The United Nations is not ruling out a continued military presence in Niger, despite a statement by the country's ruling military junta that it was ending an agreement allowing the presence of American forces for counterterrorism missions. VOA's Jeff Seldon has the latest from the Pentagon.
Days after Niger's ruling military junta announced it was kicking U.S. forces out of the country, some 1,000 U.S. troops and other military personnel are still there.
We are working through diplomatic channels to seek clarification.
Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
I don't have a time frame of any withdrawal of forces.
Singh says, despite the junta's announcement that the agreement allowing for U.S. forces to operate in Niger was being revoked immediately, U.S. officials have yet to receive any hard deadline. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
U.S. President Joe Biden will host Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. for a White House summit next month amid growing concerns about North Korea's nuclear program, provocative Chinese action in the South China Sea, and differences over Japanese companies' plan to buy an iconic American steel company. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. holds out hope for a partnership with Niger.
We are working through diplomatic channels to seek clarification. I don't have a time frame of any withdrawal of forces. We want to see our partnership continue if there is a pathway forward.
Regional analysts are concerned over Niger's future military cooperation with the United States. Liberian refugees in Ghana say their homes were demolished without notice. We'll also hear from the mayor of Gomoa East District Assembly about their situation. Gambia's parliament has failed, at least for now, to abolish the ban on female genital mutilation.
I think this is a fight to control women's bodies because these people don't care about our realities as women who have been through the practice.
And a look at Malawi's new National Development Political Party. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States is not ruling out a continuing military presence in Niger, despite a statement by the country's ruling military junta that it was ending an agreement allowing for the presence of American forces for counterterrorism missions. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has the latest from the Pentagon.
Days after Niger's ruling military junta announced it was kicking U.S. forces out of the country, some 1,000 U.S. troops and other military personnel are still there.
We are working through diplomatic channels to seek clarification.
Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
I don't have a time frame of any withdrawal of forces.
Singh says despite the junta's announcement that the agreement allowing for U.S. forces to operate in Niger was being revoked immediately, U.S. officials have yet to receive any hard deadline.
We want to see our partnership continue if there is a pathway forward.
The State Department's Vedant Patel says those discussions are being routed through the U.S. Embassy and that Washington believes it has a strong case.
Our security partnership with West African partners are mutually beneficial and are intended to achieve what we believe to be shared goals of detecting, deterring, and reducing terrorist violence and creating an environment conducive to economic and social development.
U.S. forces in Niger have essentially been on standby, with all counterterrorism operations on hold since the coup last July. But U.S. intelligence officials are increasingly concerned that terror groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda and Islamic State are growing, increasing the risk to the Sahel and beyond. Officials also worry that if the U.S. leaves, it will open the door for adversaries like Russia and Iran to move in. Concerns that appear to have rankled junta officials during a recent round of talks and might have spurred the U.S. eviction. The message from the White House, though, is that there's still some hope.
We're in touch with them.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
I'll leave it at that because those discussions with the authorities in Niger is ongoing.
If U.S. forces do have to leave Niger, Pentagon officials say there are alternatives, though some officials worry the other potential base locations may not be nearly as convenient for countering the terror threat. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Analysts in West Africa are raising concerns about U.S. military operations across the Sahel after Niger ended military cooperation with the United States on Saturday. The U.S. has hundreds of troops stationed at a drone base in northern Niger and has been helping with regional counterterrorism operations against jihadist groups. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Saturday's announcement from Niger's National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland came days after a U.S. delegation visited Niger, the second American team to visit since a group of military officers seized power last July. It remains unclear what prompted the decision to cut military ties with Washington, but Council spokesman Colonel Abdul Abdurrahman said U.S. flights over Niger's territory in recent weeks were illegal. He also said the U.S. delegation had accused Niger of a secret deal to supply uranium to Iran and showed, quote, condescending attitude against the government and people of Niger, end quote. Niger plays a pivotal role in the U.S. counterterrorism operations in Africa's Sahel region and hosts a major military air base in the city of Agadez. Security expert Saheed Shehu says there will be implications for regional security.
Certainly, we'll see a spike of security incidents in that area because the bad guys are also looking at developments. But I believe it's not going to last because America is not going to sleep. Certainly, America is going back to the drawing table to see how can they accommodate, you know, the complaint that is made by Niger and come back.
The U.S. has invested millions of dollars in its security operations in the region and has helped train Niger's military, some of whom took part in the ousting of President Mohamed Bazoum last July. The U.S. State Department Sunday said in a post on X that it was in touch with Niger's military junta. In October, U.S. authorities officially designated the military takeover in Niger as a coup and curbed security and development support to the nation. Sam Amadi, a director of the School of Social and Political Thought, says Niger's government could be looking elsewhere for a security alliance.
Well, I think it's a loss because they've spent time, money, by investing in that capability in Niger. So I see it as a loss, and I think they'll lean towards Russia. But the question is, nobody knows how effective it will be.
Niger, like neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso, turned to Russia for security support after last July's coup. In December, Niger ended its security partnership with the European Union, prompting France to withdraw its troops from the country. Shehu says the various moves by the junta are a negotiation strategy.
It will affect the general security in the area, but at the same time, I think the earlier agreement was more in favor of the United States than those countries involved. I do not see this as the end of Niger-U.S. relationship, but they are sending a signal that we need more of a collaboration of equals, you know, going forward. What I see happening later is that, you know, the kind of cooperation that is mutually beneficial. So I think the message that Niger is sending is to show America that, look, we could go elsewhere.
The U.S. and France had a combined force of 2,500 troops in Niger before the military takeover. It's not clear when or if Niger will ask the U.S. to withdraw its troops as it did with France. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Gambia's parliament failed on Monday, at least for now, to abolish the ban on female genital mutilation, FGM. The Associated Press says instead they referred the bill to a committee for further discussion and another vote later. The World Health Organization says FGM is harmful and has no health benefits. Gambia imposed hefty fines and jail sentences in 2015 for those who perform FGM. Jaha Dukure is the founder of Safe Hands for Girls, a local group that is advocating for ending the practice. She tells me the move to repeal the bill is all about controlling women's bodies by people who do not care about the health and well-being of women.
It was sent to committee, which means that they'll send it to maybe the health committee and the gender committee, and then they'll ask them to come back with a report before they're able to either vote on it again, or they might kill the bill in committee. So we don't know what's going to happen. But at least FGM is still illegal in the Gambia.
So what was the purpose?
It was motivated by Muslim religious leaders in the Gambia that are claiming that this is their religious right and this has been their culture and that this is against their human right to criminalize the practice of female genital mutilation. And they claim that Gambia doesn't practice FGM, and the activists that are fighting against FGM are influenced by the West.
Where do you think the Gambian people stand? Do they stand with you or do they stand with the other argument?
Well, to be quite honest, I think the Gambia is divided on this issue. We know that the practice of FGM for girls under the age of 15 itself is going down, because a lot of my friends that went through FGM, I know that they are not putting their daughters through FGM. A lot of the young women in this country that I spoke with, they don't believe in this practice anymore. So it's the religious leaders that are on the extreme side that are pushing this agenda, but not only pushing this agenda, they are threatening people. Like, for instance, when we mobilize a civil society for people to come out across the country that believe in our work to keep the ban on FGM, they sent out a 6-minute voice note threatening them that anyone that enters the buses that we hire should not make it there alive.
Now, you have been quoted as saying that if this law is allowed to be defeated, then other laws safeguarding women's rights could also be repealed. What kind of laws are you talking about?
the child marriage law, for instance, the domestic violence law, the laws that we have on sexual violence, I think this is a fight to control women's bodies because these people don't care about our realities as women who have been through the practice. We keep telling them that we have been subjected to FGM and we know the pain that comes with this practice, and they keep invalidating our pain and saying that these are Western ideologies. I'm the most African person I know. I love this continent more than anything else. I'm a Pan-Africanist first. So their argument is baseless.
I know you won this battle today. Do you expect they will bring it back again? The members of parliament who are in support of this, they will come back again?
I don't think we won the battle per se. I just think that this prolongs the process. The dialogue between us and them is going to continue. But I think what this creates also is an opportunity for us to lobby and put more pressure on the government of the Gambia, as well as National Assembly members. You know, deep down in my heart, I don't think the law would be reversed. But we know that, you know, it's an uphill battle. We still have a lot of work to do. And this is just the beginning of it, because even if the law doesn't get reversed, right, we have to go back to the communities, the voices that are loud and out there saying that this is their religious right. We have an obligation to educate people about the harmful effects of FGM, to bring out evidence, to bring out data, data that is from the Gambia, from our hospitals, where doctors are seeing women that are delivering children that are affected by FGM, what the consequences are.
Well, thank you so much again, Yaha. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yaha Dukure is the founder of Safe Hands for Girls, a local group that is advocating for ending the practice of FGM. She was speaking with us from the Gambian capital, Banjul. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ago, the president of the Buduburam Liberian refugee camp in Ghana called us to say that parts of the camp were being demolished by authorities. Thousands of Liberians who fled their country's civil war have been living in the camp since early 1990s. In 2010, the Ghanaian refugee board reached an agreement with the UNHCR to close Buduburam as a refugee camp. Liberians were given the option to return to Liberia or remain in Ghana. Dennis Guyon is the president of the Bujumbura camp, and he tells me the demolition began without notice.
Yesterday, by 4 a.m. in the morning, we saw yellow machines, about four, that entered the camp and decided to demolish the camp without prior notice. As we speak, they have demolished 90% of the camp.
When you say that the camps are being demolished without notice, how did you acquire where you are living?
There's a piece of land that was given by the government of Ghana since the refugees came to Ghana, and Liberians built their own structures they are living in. But to our utmost surprise, yesterday morning, the chief entered in with four good yellow machines that are destroying the property of the Liberian people here.
Who is the chief? Are you talking about the police chief?
Oh, the chief, the traditional chief of Goma Fetel Sulan, headed by one Kwesi Alhaji.
The Liberians have been living in Ghana for how many years now? And tell me, what was the arrangement?
The Liberians have been living for the past 34 years now. And the arrangement of the Buduburam camp, it is the Ghana government that brought us here. And they have never come out to tell us the arrangement of this place. So far that we are concerned, they were given to refugees to stay. They are even constructed police station, built hospital, which were taken from us later. And we have been living here like that. We are not being rent to anybody.
Do you still consider yourselves as refugees?
We were given an option. And most of the people choose to be locally integrated in this country. And they give a Liberian passport with resident permit, which have an indication in the middle of the resident permit. You can work, you can do business with a reward. And so Liberians have been tired of. There is no way you can even leave the camp. That's why Liberians are still here. And Ghana government have admitted that they made a mistake in our resident permit. And up to now, they have not even rectified that mistake. And there is nowhere that we can move. Under Buduburam, we are tied to.
What do you think is the solution, residing in Ghana or returning to Liberia?
Any of the one that is available right now that will get our people from outside where they are. As I speak to you, people that are all over in the street.
So you no longer have refugee status, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Some of us don't have refugee status. We have integrated status here. And some are still refugee. And they even dismiss some of the people who apply for the exemption clause. And they are still here, too.
So it's the Ghanaian government that you are appealing to?
The Ghanaian government, since these things happened from yesterday, they said they are not in the know. And we've been asking, since you don't aware of what's going on, then why can't you post up to A? They say they're going to investigate the matter up to now, and they are even almost demolished the camp. So we don't know whether Ghana government can help out again.
What do you estimate is the number of Liberians living in the camp now?
It's about 11,000 people.
Dennis Kuyon is the president of the Bujumbura refugee camp housing thousands of Liberians in Ghana. You're speaking with us from Accra. The mayor of the Gomoa East District Assembly in the central region of Ghana says the government played no part in the partial demolition of the Bujumbura camp housing thousands of Liberian refugees. Instead, Solomon Dako Kwam says the demolition was ordered by the local chiefs who loaned the land during the Liberian Civil War and now want it back to construct a market. Bujumbura is about 27 miles west of Accra and has been home to thousands of Liberian refugees since 1990. Mayor Dako Kwam tells me that the government was able to negotiate a temporary halt to the demolition.
Indeed, portions of the camp have been demolished, but not by central government, nor by my assembly or the county, in your case, that I represent. It is being done by the chiefs who released that land during the Liberian crisis for the resettlement of those refugees here. And apparently, somewhere 2010, the Refugee Board and UNHCR officially closed down the place. So the chiefs have, since that time, have been agitating for government to demolish or close down the place, for officially pull down the structures to make way for them to be able to get access to use their land, because Bujumbura is now a prime area. Having washed their hands off the place by the UNHCR and Refugee Board since 2010, the chiefs have been pestering government to pull down the structures and get rid of the illegal activities that goes on there. Frankly, Bujumbura has now become a haven for all sort of nationals. Togolese, Burkinabes, Ivorians, I mean, talk of any other place. And criminals have taken over the place since it was closed down, 2010. In fact, last 2021, government officially from the Jubilee House, seat of presidency, they gave me a letter to start the process of demolishing the place. 2 days to the date, it was halted because Liberian Foreign Affairs and High Power Delegation paid a visit to the Ghana government. And so they planned to postpone the thing small for certain repatriation and those things to be done. Unfortunately, since that time till date, we keep assuring the chiefs. So the chiefs, just out of the blue, decided that they can't wait for us anymore. So it was they themselves that took it upon themselves to pull down certain places to create a market, because there is a construction that is happening on the same stretch of the road. So the people say they wanted a place to do a market for, to resettle their women from selling around the roadside. That notwithstanding, we brought it to the attention of the Regional Security Council, who invited myself, the chiefs, and then Refugee Board representative. We sat over the matter. And well, at least we managed to appeal to the chiefs to exercise some restraint. So as I speak, the demolition has halted, even though the chiefs have threatened and have actually given government that 1 month ultimatum, that if they don't hear anything, they will resume.
It's so good to talk with you. I appreciate very much.
I'm so grateful too.
Solomon Dako Kwam is the mayor of Gomoa East District Assembly in the central region of Ghana. He was speaking with us from Ghana. The National Development Party, NDP, is Malawi's newest opposition party. Its Secretary General says the core reason for its formation, despite a plethora of opposition parties, is to give hope to citizens. But critics say that the new party appears to be state-sponsored with the objective of dividing the opposition to ensure the re-election of incumbent President Lazaro Chakwera in next year's general election. For more about the newly formed NDP, VOA's Peter Clotet reached its Secretary General, Gerald Chilongu.
The core reason, I think, is for us to be able to participate in the political discourse of Malawi. And basically, that was one of the reasons why we had to come up with National Development Party. But again, there are a lot of other things that Malawi has aspirations and dreams. I'll probably put it in this way to say, there are a lot of things which the previous government and the current government isn't really living up to its promises somehow, somewhere. And Malawians are actually suffering. They've been aiming for a change for a long, long time. And this is the reason why we actually had to come to make sure that we actually fill in the space and be able to give Malawians some kind of hope which they've been looking for or waiting for a long time.
By forming this party a year ahead of the election, don't you think your impact could be minimal at least?
I mean, it started off some, I would say, 2 years ago, and the legislative political party had to do what they could do or they were supposed to do to comply with the laws governing the legislation of political party. And then finally, we got it registered on the 1st of March. But then that said, again, at the end of the day, it's the message of hope that NDP has. To me, that's what really would be the thing that would actually give us an edge, even though there's only maybe 17 months before we go to the elections next year. So there's still time for us, you know, as far as we're concerned.
Some of your critics are saying that there are too many political parties already in Malawi and that the formation of your party appeared to be government-sponsored to divide the front of the opposition.
People will probably be able to say whatever they can say. To us, and as far as we are concerned, we have no connections, links whatsoever with any political party. And I guess people have got their own opinion in as far as what you are saying here is concerned, but there's no proof that they can actually present before us to say this party was formed behind the support of any other than what we've been hearing. But there's absolutely nothing like that.
What do you say to your critics who are of the opinion that the leader of your party, Frank, himself, is being paid by the government? So how can he be an effective opposition leader with him being fed by the same government, they argue? What's your response to that?
But my president, for sure and for real, indeed, he's working with the government in a way because he's the chairman of the Northern Region Water Board. But again, at the end of the day, the president of the country is attributed to choose anyone else who could actually give good service to the people of Malawi. He's demonstrated that in as far as his leadership is concerned. And then I don't necessarily see anything wrong in that.
Gerald Chilongo is the Secretary General of Malawi's newly formed political party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotet. A prominent Democratic Republic of Congo journalist was sentenced Monday to 6 months in prison for allegedly incriminating military intelligence in the murder of an opposition politician. Stanis Bujakera, 33, has been jailed since September over an article in Jeune Afrique magazine that suggests Congolese military intelligence operators had killed opposition politician Cherubin Okende the month before. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing you will have an amazing Tuesday.
A group of 12 women are recipients of this year's International Women of Courage Award. Three of them are from Africa. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we will introduce you to women who have demonstrated remarkable courage and determination in advocating for the rights of fellow women. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.